has sprung and leaping like a lamb in a mosh pit. It's Music Weekly from Guardian.co.uk. I'm Paul McInnes, and on this week's show, we'll listen in on the idiosyncratic sound of Dan Deacon. We'll review new music from Mikachu, Peaches and Pink Mountaintops in Singles Club. The feature with no name will get to grips with young marble giants, and there will be faceback. We shall start, forsooth, by getting Shakespearean on your asses. This is Titus Andronicus. Indeed was Titus Andronicus, the name of the Bard's most bloodthirsty play, and now a five-piece band from Glen Rock, New Jersey, who like their pogues, their literature, and their booze. Not necessarily in that order, neither. And probably all at the same time, too. International man about town, Tim Jones, was the only one for this job, and he caught up with them when they were in the UK recently. It went a little something like this.
A lot of people have mentioned the pogues as an influence. I actually hear a bit of Andrew WK as well. Are you fans of Andrew WK?
Equally valid. Right, okay. Huge fans of both the Pogues and Andrew WK.
One of the defining moments in my life was when I saw Andrew WK's video for Party Hard on 120 Minutes when I was like 16 years old, 2 o'clock in the morning. Really blew my mind. I love that guy.
It's fantastic music, very intense and bombastic. Really gets you excited.
Definitely too much.
Yeah. You like to overdo it. Do you think there's a possibility of an Andrew WK revival?
Well, probably not in the English-speaking world, but I'm told that he's still quite popular in Japan.
Oh, really?
Well, over in America, he doesn't really do much music anymore, but he serves as like an MC at a lot of events, or like he does speaking engagements lectures and stuff.
He owns a venue in New York City.
He's become quite the brand name, okay. But his music is still fantastic.
And what is it about the Pogues that you like?
They're quite rousing, and they've got stirring tunes that lift the spirits. Shane McGowan is certainly a very wonderful singer. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be so immodest as to compare myself to him, being that he's one of the best ever. But thank you.
Do you have any songs that stand out for you as really representative of what you're trying to do as a band?
Well, that would be hard to say, wouldn't it? For us. Mm-hmm.
Guess it would be the we're too
close to that stuff to answer that with any kind of objectivity.
Though when I was talking to Patrick about the band a while ago, he said that the idea of the band was to have folk songs that had like a deep shoegaze texture on top of them, and I think that the thing that achieves that best is the song No Future Part 2, which is probably us at our most shoegaziest, which is my favorite extreme of the thing that we do.
So are you all shoegaze fans?
Andrew and I really quite love shoegaze.
Yeah.
Because there's a big shoegaze revival at the moment, especially over here.
So. New gaze.
Yeah.
I don't know if we necessarily love shoegaze music.
We love Galaxy 500.
Galaxy 500 is great. But even they're kind of more like dream pop. You know, like they're kind of proto-shoegaze. It counts, yeah. But like much shoegaze music is quite boring at times. But they definitely are the best-sounding guitars around.
Okay.
That's why that band Fucked Up so great. You've got the new Fucked Up album over here, I assume? Because they're the best shoegaze band in the world right now. Mm-hmm. And they're also a hardcore band, which makes it very exciting.
So I guess by shoegaze, we just mean really noisy guitars.
Gaze-core. No, but that music is... Gaze-core. Those guitars are super shoegazy.
Yeah.
See, but they have taken the best elements of shoegaze, I feel, and applied them to a form of music that's a little more viscerally exciting than traditional, like, dirgy, you know, shoegaze music. Although that is also quite nice listening sometimes.
Rain around this room.
That was Tim Jones talking to the boys from Titus Andronicus, and their album The Airing of Grievances is available now. Time, however, to move on and welcome into the pod the one, the only, the Swash. How are you?
Hello. Michael Han is looking at my notes.
He just wants to feel part of the club because he doesn't get a script as a guest, you see. He wants a script, don't you, Michael?
When you're
yeah, actually, Michael Han's sorry, not even I'll here. Say... Michael Han's not even here. Rosie, sorry, how are you? Michael... Rosie, how are you?
I'm fine.
Good. I want to ask about this airing of grievances thing, just quickly.
Yes.
Because I searched the album to find out when it was out. The first 10 results on Google, all illegal uploads.
Oh.
What does that say? What does that say about the state of the music industry when you can't even find the official album online? Anyway, that is all I have to say on that matter. I've got a big surprise for you all out there in Podland. Because coming up next at Singles Club this week, our guest reviewer on Singles Club is Michael Han.
Hello, Paul. Hello, Rosie. I'll do my best to disappoint.
Let's start the Singles Club. Our first track this week is While We Were Dreaming. It's by Pink Mountain Tops. And if I could find your heart, I would pull it from your chest and smash you with my fist till it was beating. And if there's a hole inside the heaven in your head, 'cause that angel that you kissed just left you bleeding. That was Pink Mountain Tops with While We Were Dreaming. Stephen McBean of Pink Mountain Tops is also Stephen McBean of Black Mountain and a previous guest on this pod. This side project may maintain McBean's mountain-based naming system, but it does also explore a softer side to Black Mountain's trademark psych rock. Rosie, yes. Over to you.
It's actually Amber Webber's voice who's also in Black Mountain. She's got an incredibly distinctive, wonderful voice. I love it a lot. And I think she's singing there with her sister, Ashley Webber, who usually sings with Bonnie Prince Billy. A bit of fact for you. I do really like the Pink Mountain Tops. I didn't like the stuff they did before this all that much. And when I first listened to this album, which is called Outside Love, last week, I thought, God, it's just, you know, totally Jesus and Mary Chain, occasionally a bit like Arcade Fire. It is quite like that. I think the opening chords of this song sound like Just Like Honey. But it's so different from what they do with Black Mountain, and all of Black Mountain participate in the recording of this album. She's just got such an amazing voice, and the lyrics are quite, at points there, I think, a little oblique and quite weird.
Not just one fact, umpteen there. Yeah. Good work, Rosie. Michael, do you concur?
Do I concur with the facts or with the opinion?
Well, you can't disagree with the facts. They are facts, but
I
do you
can,
concur with the opinion?
Actually, that's Bonnie Langford singing that. It's her first venture into the Canadian psych rock scene, and I think Bonnie's done very well. It's certainly banished.
Whenever you like, Michael, whenever you like, just get on to the review.
I have nothing to say. I like it. I have nothing to say about it. It reminded me of watching that Rough Trade thing the other night and seeing Mazzy Star on telly for the first time in years, and this sounds just like Mazzy Star, if you like. Things that sound like the Velvet Underground, sung by a blank-voiced American or Canadian woman, then this is for you. It's fine for me, but literally, I've heard this record so many times, I can think of nothing to say about it.
It reminded me of the Velvets too. What I found about the vocals was that compared to somebody like Nico, they were a little bit flatter.
It's quite interesting, this thing, that it's become the template. When people do music that's roughly inspired by the Velvet Underground, you've got to make sure your singer is completely affectless, and while they sing about injecting or killing themselves or what have you, there is no expression or emotion in their voice, whatever. It seems like an odd thing to do. I'd quite like to hear this kind of music sung by somebody who sounded like they cared.
That's quite tender, though, the vocals, no?
Yeah, I mean, I completely disagree with you both, and I think her voice is absolutely amazing. And partly, I think, yeah, I get the disaffection thing totally, but I think knowing the sort of wider context of her material and of Black Mountain Tops, I think that they get something in their music which is not so much human, but they seem, I personally feel that there's quite a lot of panorama and atmosphere in what they do, and maybe the vocals don't always, and I agree with you, it could be a bit more human, but I genuinely think she's got an absolutely, I can see how it could go straight through you, but that vibrato and the power in it, it's great.
It's unusual for Bonnie Langford though, isn't it?
It is very unusual.
Oh, Michael Pulley. That brought an end to that discussion, Michael. The words Bonnie Langford are going to be the last we hear on that review, because that was While We Were Dreaming by Pink Mountain Tops, and that song will feature on the album Outside Love, which comes out at the beginning of May on Jaguar. Next up on Singles Club is Lips by Mikachu. Mikachu with Lips. Another former guest on this pod, Mika Levy, aka Mikachu, is perhaps the only musician in London who's a part-time grime MC, part-time composer of symphonies, and expert in playing the vacuum cleaner. Much like the dude, Mikachu is also into the whole brevity thing, with the majority of her songs on debut album Jewelry coming in at under 3 minutes, apart from one, which is nearly half an hour long. It's pretty contrarian, eh, Michael? And I guess it takes one to know one, no?
That is the best single of this year by a mile. It will not be beaten. I suspect there won't be a better album track than that this year. It's perfect in every single respect. It's a great British pop single. It sounds utterly uncontrived. It sounds like it's come absolutely out of nowhere. No idea what she would have been listening to from that single. I mean, could you discern a single influence? But it sounds so perfectly of the moment. What it reminds me of, actually, although this isn't at all of the moment, is Adam and the Ants. Ant music came on my iPod when I was walking home the other day, two songs after this. And they're such kind of brethren records, things that are all about throwing together wild sounds that shouldn't work together and seeing what we end up with. And I think it's fantastic. It's exciting. Never as it overstays its welcome. I haven't got a clue what she's singing about, but I'm not really fussed about that. I just love the sounds in it. Every single sound is unexpected.
And maybe the fact that it's 1 minute and 20 seconds long means it doesn't outstay its welcome.
No, I would accept that there's something to that, but more records should be 80 seconds long.
Yeah, I think it's cool. And I think there is something very of the moment about that. It's the Twitter of a pop song. It's just the meat and nothing else. Rosie.
Yes.
What do you think about it?
I continue to love Mikachu, as we did when she was a guest on our pod all those months ago.
Oh, many, many months ago.
We broke her. We broke her.
Michael, do you think we should get her back in the pod? Because we feel like we kind of interviewed her too early.
Well, I'd never heard of her until I heard you guys on the pod talking about Mikachu.
That's very nice. Should we have her back, though? Do you think, or if you go back for seconds, is it...
I think you should have her back, trying to play her songs on the stuff that is in the studio. Because that's what she uses, whatever's around, doesn't she? Yeah. Vacuum cleaners, half-size guitars, quarter sherbet lemons... And yeah, go on, get her to recreate her album in 25 seconds on the stuff in here.
Okay, back to you, Rosie, for some critical evaluation.
Yes, all the things that Michael said is what's great about her. I love the fact that her album is called Jewelry, because actually when you know, probably looking a little bit too deeply into it, but kind of what's great about the album as a whole and the way that she forms these songs is it's like a jewelry box of all these different beautiful, weird and wonderful things that sitting together in a box don't work or shouldn't work. But a brilliant and individual gems. And there's something, you know, that thrown together, hearing sounds that no one else hears, sourcing sounds from places that other people don't. It's great. And, you know, she has always got good pop melodies in there. She's brilliant.
I think it's sort of fantastic. Although she clearly comes out of the scene, she hangs around with all those people, Jack Peñate and what have you, doesn't she? This record doesn't sound like it's come out of any scene at all. It doesn't sound like she's been hanging around with the Hoxton set or whoever. That might be a result of coming from Guildford, of course, where there's a very particular cultural outlook on the world.
Done. It's by Mikachu, is on Jewelry, which is out now on Rough Trade
What
Records.
Did you think of it though, Paul?
Oh, I love Mikachu. I go on about Mikachu all the time. I think she's brilliant, and all I can do is concur and echo exactly what you said, because she is a one-off. She's super clever, but she's also of the street. You know, there's nothing pretentious about it. It is trying to get to a groove, to get to a rhythm, to kind of get people dancing, shaking, moving, but it's very thoughtful as well.
I'm going to say this, she is even better than Kid British.
All right, well, that was Mikachu. I've already told you the album details, so we'll move on to our final track on Singles Club this week, and it's More by Peaches. That's More by Peaches. Meryl Beth Lisker, aka Peaches, is a Berlin-based electro artist. She is Canadian and used to share a flat with Feist. She is 41 years old. Because this is a family podcast, I'm not going to mention any of the dirty stuff Peaches does, particularly not her expressed opinion that men are best at taking it up the arse. Michael. No, sorry, it's my turn. I love this track because it's dirty, not because of the lyrics, although there aren't much of those, but because of the production, which is by previous pod guest Simeon Mobile Disco. It sounds like to me how it would feel if you were to visit an electricity substation, ignore the danger of death signs, climb right in and end up having a breakdancing competition with Darth Vader. And that is all I have to say on the matter. Michael.
I don't know where one goes from there, Paul. I mean, having a breakdancing competition in an electricity substation with Darth Sidious would be scarier.
I raise you a Darth.
What I like about this record is that it doesn't remind me of dance records or techno records or electro records or anything. It sounds like the Stooges. I have a real soft spot for those electro records that just have two chords alternated all the way through, because they do sound like the Stooges and Suicide to me. And, you know, she comes out of that whole performance art background as well, which I'm afraid is a statement of the blind and the obvious from me, but I slightly lost track of where I was going there. So can I imagine dancing to it in an electricity substation? No.
But that's because you're too practical to ever climb over the bloody gates.
That's because I am too practical. They have signs saying, please don't climb, it's very dangerous. And Peaches might be in here with Darth Sidious. But yes, I'd say thumbs up to Peaches.
Rosie.
I don't love this track. When I first heard it, I thought, ooh, and then to me it's quite of that electro clash stuff, which what I liked about it is that there's something kind of a little bit damaged sounding about it. There's an androgyny there and it's all trashy colours and all that sort of stuff, which I think Peaches was absolutely brilliant at. But I feel like this is her fifth album kind of want to sell some records now song, because it's, to me, it's really anodyne and quite unlike her. I mean, I know her last album there was song, you know, Slippery Dick and, you know, all these, you know, ridiculous songs that were kind of hard to hear. You know, she was a female artist that kind of was uncompromising in that way, and there's nothing really about this that I get from this record.
But don't you think that tells us more about how the left field has invaded the mainstream than about Peaches? The fact that something that is formants are just two really deep throbbing bass notes alternating can be considered to be a bid for mainstream acceptability.
Well,
I mean, if you listen to daytime radio now and you hear records that, I don't know, when
but
I think kid,
Rosie's talking
Peel
about...
They would just have been John Peel things. Wouldn't have gotten near the daytime. I think this is one of those.
But Rosie's talking about the lyrical content or absence thereof as much as anything, aren't you? I mean, what I would say about that is that this is a B-side of a double A-side single. I'm sure within the package of the album as a whole, there will be a lot more...
filth!
Dicks and sucking going on. I take your point, actually. I do think it is one for the club. But I just think that it does have a distinct character of Peaches in there, because it is so raucous, it's so loud, and it is very, very dark in the sine waves that go kind of pulsing through your head. It's just uncompromising in that regard. So that's where I think maybe it's still Peaches. Move by Peaches will be part of a double A side with Talk to Me, which will be out on XL, and you can listen to it right now on her MySpace. Over to the blog, where Bugs Raplin had been doing a bit of detective work. Oh yes, he'd been digging around on last week's singles, specifically Ultraviolet by Theophilus London. You know that on Ultraviolet, Theo's just rhyming over a fairly recent John Mouse track, My Whole World Is Coming Apart? No one's really pointed that out, as far as I can tell. If you have any revelations to expose about this week's tracks from Peaches, Mikachu or Pink Mountaintops, post at theguardian.co.uk/musicweekly. And while you're at it, you can share your thoughts on these other tracks they're out to buy next week. Animal Collective, My Girls. Peter, Bjorn and John, Nothing to Worry About. You can hold on, but I wouldn't waste your time. The Kills, Black Balloon. Farewell, my black balloon. Farewell, my black balloon. White Lies,
farewell to the fairground.
Thank you very much, Michael Hann.
Thank you and sorry.
That's it for Singles Club. Now, please don't forget you can actually read reviews each Wednesday on the site at Guardian/music. If you can actually read, that is.
Hello, we are Pet Shop Boys.
And you're listening to Music Weekly
on guardian.co.uk.
Now, dear listeners, pray tune your ears to the sounds of the inimitable Dan Deacon. Dan Deacon, arch music experimentalist of Baltimore. Seeing as he's from Baltimore, Rosie, he's going to know Avon Barksdale, right?
I didn't ask him that, but seeing as Avon Barksdale is a fictional character from a fictional TV series, I'm sorry to break this to you, Paul. The Wire is not real. Do you want me to just, shall we just move on and I'll tell you some nice things about Dan Deacon to cheer you up?
Okay, go on.
All right. So he's been described as everything from the Salvador Dali of music to an electronic wizard to plain old bonkers. And I think it's an image no doubt helped by the fact that he lives in an art music collective in Baltimore called Wham City. And he's a bit of a gadget fiend whose previous album, Spider-Man of Mars, seemed to incorporate everything from techno to gabba to noise to all sorts of things. And at times, very hard on the ear. But his music is genuinely wonderful, and his new album, Brumps, which comes out next week, is very different. And the words that I put to him is meditative.
I wanted the pieces to be a lot more dense and intricate, but also more delicate and require a bit more finesse and fidelity when they'd be performed live. And I wanted the pieces to be have the same sort of euphoric tone, but deal with darker subjects. And I think the word meditative is a good choice. Like, pieces that were dance music, but not just music that you would party to, music that I like to think of it in terms of, like, during a party to a celebration, where, like, a party is just sort of, like, getting together and letting loose, and a celebration is doing that.
One of the other things I noticed about the album was maybe a lack of the kind of cultural references we've heard on your stuff before, namely the animated characters and the Looney Tunes stuff, and I guess move on from those references which people have come to know you by.
It's weird. I never really think of myself as being known by those, but I guess since the Woody Woodpecker was the only sample on the last record, and I guess that, well, I guess they also had that track called Pink Batman, and it was called Spider-Man of the Ring. So
I see
what you're talking about, man. I really like the recontextualization of ideas, and really influenced by, you know, people like Negative Land and people like us, and I think a lot of American culture from my generation grew up in a time where advertising and, you know, the use of characters to children was really huge. A lot of these characters and cartoon characters and pop icons and comic book heroes and stuff have been sort of ingrained in like American contemporary folk mythology, sort of in my mind, and I like to think of them that way as not really these corporate icons, but just something that's just like ingrained in the like American psyche.
It's probably just coincidence, but there's three bands, including yourself, who I love, and the other two are Celebration and Ponytail. All three of you share like this real mind-bending, cacophonous ability to make music. And I wondered whether, I mean, is there something about Baltimore or the scene there or that produces these particular kinds of bands that make this particular quite mental kind of music?
I don't know. There's certainly a lot going on and a lot of music that I think is really incredible coming out of Baltimore at the moment. I think a lot of it has to do with the climate of the city. It's a very big city, but not very largely populated. It's about half the population of what it could be and once was, and it's really dilapidated and falling apart and doesn't really get that much attention, or at least it didn't in the past. And it sort of is a town where if you want to do something fun, you sort of have to do it yourself, and no one's really going to provide it for you. And I think, like, for a while, like, bands would skip over the city and just, you know, play just, you know, they'd play D.C. and then drive straight to New York, or D.C. and then Philly, and, like, you know, when bands tour, they want to play as many places as possible, but they also want to cover as much ground in a shorter period of time, so Baltimore would get skipped over quite a bit. And it's not a very wealthy city, so there's not a lot of money getting poured into it, and sort of has this, like, creepy, sinister sort of vibe, but at the same time, I think the community here is really, really interconnected and interwoven, even, you know, in, like, a very radically different aesthetic sort of level, like, where, you know, bands like myself and Beach House and, you know, Nautical Almanac and all make radically different types of music from very different approaches, but are at the same sort of events on a regular basis. And I don't know, it's a very interconnected city, and I feel that's really important for a scene. And I think, you know, the economic and cultural and criminal climate of the city really help enhance that.
Did you fall in love with Baltimore straight away when you moved there? Because it's kind of sold to the rest of the world as a hard place to exist.
No. In fact, I didn't. I don't think anyone in Wham City did. We sort of had a rough go the first year or so, mainly because we didn't really know anyone here, and we only hung out with ourselves, and we're awful drinkers, and never really left our warehouse, and it was full of garbage, and just sort of smashed everything, and any sort of relationship that was had was destroyed. And it was very, very different from any place I had ever lived. It took a while to get used to, and as soon as we branched out and stopped being so insular, it became a lot better. And I guess as soon as we started having shows in our house, that's when everything sort of changed. That's when it became like paradise. Tired of studying serialism, and just really enjoying Andy Kaufman and weird experimental pop like Devo or Boussac or Raven Scott and stuff like that, and wanted to incorporate those ideas. You know, even a lot of, you know, 20th century contemporary quote-unquote classical music is really takes itself seriously to a point of it being like a major fault, you know, like serialism and, you know, postmodernism, and composers like Stockhausen and Boulez and Milton Babbitt, like, seem to have, you know, no sense of humor and no joy for music. Like, they were like musical fetishists almost. I hated that. I think that's why a lot of my early pieces were like The Adventures of Mr. Bumbershine featuring Dr. Witherbean and stuff like that. And I don't know if it was so much like a rebellion against the seriousness, but I do think it was a comment on academia and the academic mindset that contemporary composition had.
We should just say this, you studied composition at college, and you mentioned there Raymond Scott, which I'm quite interested in, because he wasn't the original composer behind some of the Looney Tunes music, but his compositions were used in the Looney Tunes series?
Yeah, they were used quite a bit. Well, he wrote a lot of like jazz tunes that got pretty popular, or like jazz band songs. He had just like a really weird approach to music, but he had great commercial success, and what I'm saying, made it easy for him to develop ideas that I don't think he otherwise would have been able to. He had a great deal of money at his disposal, so he could try out building these weird instruments. And I guess he was the one who first employed Bob Moog, who started Moog Synthesizers and helped fund that company quite a bit. And just sort of, you know, would come up with an idea and be like, can this be invented? And here's how I want it to sound. And invent it for me. And then started inventing stuff on his own. And started, the thing that interests me the most about him was his use of randomness and using random number generators to calculate rhythms and pitches and chord progressions and changes. And I think that's the most intriguing part about his work and makes it such beautiful and experimental pop music. ¶¶
What's your favourite song to perform?
I guess right now it's probably Snookered.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
From the new album.
It's the most fun to play with the ensemble. It starts off with just a glockenspiel player and a sine wave player and just builds really slowly and organically. And I just really like the breakdown in the middle is the section of chopped up Beach Boys samples and just drums. And I don't know, I just really like, that's probably my favorite track of mine at the moment.
Deacon from Baltimore on the phone. No Avon Barksdale, I'm afraid, but Bromps is out next week.
He's real. He's definitely real. There's no two ways about it. Thank you so much, Rosie. I hope you're not too tired after that, though, because I don't know if he told you, but we're about to queue you up to do the feature with No Name as well. Yeah, it's true. Here you are talking about the young marble giant.
One of those bands that seem to have been thrown together by circumstance, only for something brilliant and beautiful to bloom. Philip and Stuart Moxham were brothers. Alison Statton was roped in because she was Phil's girlfriend. There was even a cousin at one point, though he didn't stick around long. The trio were from Cardiff and they formed in 1978. They only produced one album, Colossal Youth, before splitting in 1981. That lone LP captured the imagination of a cult audience which still exists to this day. With a little more than a homemade drum machine, minimalist guitars, and Alison Statton's purer than pure singing voice, their sound was pastel, suburban, maudlin, and lo-fi. It could also be menacing, shrill, and creepy. On songs like Salad Days, the music begins and it could be a forgotten grunge record. Then Statton starts singing, and it sounds like something you've genuinely never heard before. Statton's voice which made Young Marble Giant so captivating, because she was meant to sound like a singer who couldn't really sing, though mainly she sounded like someone yet to discover what a rotten place the world could be. Hers sounded like the voice of an unbroken heart. Their sound was also misleading in its simplicity, particularly in the intricacies of its electronic arrangements. The Moxham brothers managed to sound unpredictable without sounding discordant, their guitar and bass helping to create something so soft and quiet, and yet so huge. The influence can be felt from the vocals of Long Blonde's Kate Jackson to Kurt Cobain, who once said Colossal Youth was one of his favourite records. Despite being one of Rough Trade's most beloved bands, the trio split in 1981, fulfilling Stuart Moxham's prophecy that theirs was a band never meant to last. Alison Statton formed jazz influence group Weekend, Stuart formed The Gist, but their past came calling in 2004 and they reunited on stage for a BBC performance. This year, they will come together once again to perform Colossal Youth in its entirety at ATP this May. Testament, it would seem, to the enduring appeal of one of the most understated albums ever made. When the rich die last, like the rabbits running from a lucky pass, full of shallow cunning, and the world lights up for the final day, we will all be poor, having had our say.
Nice work, Rosie. And you can now rest for 5 seconds. No more. As we go through some face back. Nicolaj Steenmoller wrote on Facebook, "Thank you ever so much for the double Pet Shop Boys feast with a Blue Nile tribute on top," which surely sounds like the words of someone who's never left 1989, doesn't it? Nah. Over on the blog, however, it was some of our guests who were accused of living in the past. Barry Marshall wrote, "As much as I was happy about the return of Pet Shop Boys, I cringed at the excerpt of the song with the lines, 'The car found warehouse boys being on the phone, he wants to upgrade your mobile you own,' or something like that. I think we have a challenger for Desiree's title of crappiest rhyming couplet in a modern pop song." I think that's what the Pet Shop Boys do, isn't it? Kind of matter of fact, pop cultural or just cultural references. Anyway, Rosie.
Yeah. Ida Augustinson said on our Facebook site, "Nice episode of the podcast. Just want to inform you that you can see both Karen and Olof Dreyer's face in the knife video for You Take My Breath Away. So that's secret. They aren't." Hello to our new Facebook friends. We've got hello to North Atlantic Oscillation, Winter Kicks, Juliet Cronk, Elliot Music Law, Ray McLaughlin, and Michael Regina.
Can I say my favourite name out of those? Juliet Cronk.
Yeah.
Anyway, head to guardian.co.uk/musicweekly to post your thoughts on everything this show has to offer, and you can do the same on Facebook. Search Music Weekly to become a fan. And we're gradually coming to terms with the new layout of Facebook, which I found very bamboozling so far, but we're getting better at it. Anyway, I'm afraid that brings us to the end, though, of this week's podcast. Thank you to Michael. Thank you so much to Rosie.
You're welcome.
Oh, thanks. And we'll see you from next Friday. Bye-bye.